Chapter 92. After the excess of their excitement had had an interval in which to cool down, I bought a revolver once and traveled 1,200 miles to kill a man. He was away. He was gone a day. With nothing else to do, I had to stop and think, and did. Within an hour, within half of it, I was ashamed of myself and felt unspeakably ridiculous. I do not know what to call it, if I was not insane. During a whole week my head was in a turmoil night and day, fierce enough, and exhausting enough to upset a stronger reason than mine. All over the world, every day, there are some millions of men in that condition temporarily. And in that time there is always a moment, perhaps only a single one, when they would do murder, if their man was at hand. If the opportunity comes a shade too late, the chances are that it has come permanently too late. Opportunity seldom comes exactly at the supreme moment. This saves a million lives a day in the world, for sure. No ruler is ever slain, but the tremendous details of it are ravenously devoured by 100,000 men whose minds dwell, unaware, near the temporary insanity frontier, and over they go now. There is a day, 2 days, three, during which no ruler would be safe from perhaps the half of them, and there is a single moment wherein he would not be safe from any of them, no doubt. It may take this present shooting case 6 months to breed another ruler tragedy, but it will breed it. There is at least one mind somewhere which will brood, and wear, and decay itself to the killing point and produce that tragedy. Every Negro burned at the stake unsettles the excitable brain of another one, I mean the inflaming details of his crime, and the lurid theatricality of his exit, do it and the duplicate crime follows, and that begets a repetition, and that one another one, and so on. Every lynching account unsettles the brains of another set of excitable white men, and lights another pyre. 115 lynchings last year, 102 inside of 8 months this year. In 10 years this will be habit, on these terms. Yes, the wild talk you see in the papers, and from men who are sane, when not upset by overwhelming excitement. A U.S. Senator Cullum wants this Buffalo criminal lynched. It would breed other lynchings of men who are not dreaming of committing murders now, and will commit none, if Cullum will keep quiet, and not provide the exciting cause. And a district attorney wants a law which shall punish with death attempts upon a president's life. This, mind you, as a deterrent. It would have no effect, or the opposite one. The lunatic's mind space is all occupied, as mine was, with the matter in hand. There is no room in it for reflections upon what may happen to him. That comes after the crime. It is the noise the attempt would make in the world that would breed the subsequent attempts, by unsettling the rickety minds of men who envy the criminal his vast notoriety, his obscure name tongued by stupendous kings and emperors, his picture printed everywhere, the trivialest details of his movements, what he eats, what he drinks, how he sleeps, what he says. Cable day brought over the whole globe at cost of $50,000 a day, and he only a lowly shoemaker yesterday. Like the assassin of the president of France, in debt 3 francs to his landlady, and insulted by her, and today she is proud to be able to say she knew him as familiarly as you know your own brother, and glad to stand till she drops and pour out columns and pages of her grandeur and her happiness upon the eager interviewer. Nothing will check the lynchings and ruler murder, but absolute silence, the absence of pow-pow about them. How are you going to manage that? By gagging every witness and jamming him into a dungeon for life. By abolishing all newspapers. By exterminating all newspaper men. And by extinguishing God's most elegant invention, the human race. It is quite simple. Quite easy, and I hope you will take a day off and attend to it, Joe. I blow a kiss to you, and am lovingly yours, Mark. When the Adirondack summer ended, Clemens settled for the winter in the beautiful Appleton home at Riverdale on the Hudson. It was a place of wide spreading grass, and shade, a house of ample room. They were established in it in time for Mark Twain, to take an active interest in the New York elections, and assist a ticket for good government to defeat Tammany Hall. XLI, Letters of 1902. Riverdale. York Harbor. Illness of Mrs. Clemens. The year 1902 was an eventful one for Mark Twain. In April he received a degree of LL.D. from the University of Missouri, and returned to his native state to accept it. This was his last journey to the Mississippi River. During the summer Mrs. Clemens' health broke down, and illnesses of one sort or another visited other members of the family. Amid so much stress and anxiety, Clemens had little time or inclination for work. He wrote not many letters and mainly somber ones. Once, by way of diversion, he worked out the idea of a curious club which he formed its members, to be young girls, girls for the most part whom he had never seen. They were elected without their consent from among those who wrote to him without his consent, and it is not likely that anyone so chosen declined membership. One selection from his letters to the French member, Miss Helen Picard, of Saint-Di, France, will explain the club and present-day side of Mask Twain somewhat different from that found in most of his correspondence. To Miss Picard, in Saint-Di, France. Riverdale on the Hudson, February 22, 1902. Dear Miss Helen, if you will let me call you so, considering that my head is white, and that I have grown-up daughters. Your beautiful letter has given me such deep pleasure. I will make bold to claim you for a friend, and lock you up with the rest of my riches, for I am a miser who counts his spoil every day, and hoards it secretly, and adds to it when he can, and is grateful to see it grow. Some of that gold comes, like yourself, in a sealed package, and I can't see it, and may never have the happiness. But I know its value without that, and by what sum it increases my wealth. I have a club, a private club, which is all my own. I appoint the members myself, and they can't help themselves, because I don't allow them to vote on their own appointment and I don't allow them to resign. They are all friends whom I have never seen, save one, but who have written friendly letters to me. By the laws of my club there can be only one member in each country, and there can be no male member but myself. Someday I may admit males, but I don't know, they are capricious and inharmonious, and their ways provoke me a good deal. It is a matter which the club shall decide. I have made 4 appointments in the past 3 or 4 months. You as member for France, a young Highland girl as member for Scotland, a Mohammedan girl as member for Bengal, and a dear and bright young niece of mine as member for the United States, for I do not represent a country myself, but a merely member at large for the human race. You must not try to resign, for the laws of the club do not allow that. You must console yourself by remembering that you are in the best of company, that nobody knows of your membership except myself, that no member knows another's name, but only her country, that no taxes are levied, and no meetings held, but how dearly I should like to attend one. One of my members is a princess of a royal house, another is the daughter of a village bookseller on the continent of Europe. For the only qualification for membership is intellect, and the spirit of goodwill. Other distinctions, hereditary or acquired, do not count. May I send you the constitution and laws of the club? I shall be so pleased if I may. It is a document which one of my daughters typewrites for me, when I need one for a new member, and she would give her eyebrows to know what it is all about, but I strangle her curiosity by saying, there are much cheaper typewriters than you are, my dear, and if you try to pry into the sacred mysteries of this club, one of your prosperities will perish sure. My favorite? It is Joan of Arc. My next is Huckleberry Finn, but the family's next is the Prince and the Pauper. Yes, you are right, I am a moralist in disguise. It gets me into heaps of trouble when I go thrashing around in political questions. I wish you every good fortune and happiness, and I thank you so much for your letter. Sincerely yours, S. 50. Clemens. Early in the year, Clemens paid a visit to Twitchell in Hartford, and after one of their regular arguments on theology and the moral accountability of the human race, arguments that had been going on between them for more than 30 years, Twitchell lent his visitor Freedom of the Will, by Jonathan Edwards, to read on the way home. The next letter was the result. To Rev. J. H. Twitchell, in Hartford. Riverdale on the Hudson. February 02. Dear Joe, sir, compliments. Meaning, had a good time you gave me. What a happiness it was to be under your roof again. Etc., etc. See opening sentence of all translations of letters passing between Lord Roberts and Indian princes and rulers. From Bridgeport to New York, thence to home, and continuously until near midnight I wallowed, and reeked with Jonathan in his insane debauch, rose immediately refreshed and fine at 10 this morning, but with a strange and haunting sense of having been on a 3 days tier with a drunken lunatic. It is years since I have known these sensations. All through the book is the glaze of a resplendent intellect gone mad, a marvelous spectacle. No, not all through the book. The drunk does not come until the last third, where what I take to be Calvinism and its God begins to show up and shine red and hideous in the glow from the fires of hell, their only right and proper adornment. By God, I was ashamed to be in such company. Jonathan seems to hold as against the Arminian position that the man, or his soul, or his will, never creates an impulse itself, but is moved to action by an impulse back of it. That's sound. Also, that of two or more things offered it, it infallibly chooses the one which for the moment is most pleasing to itself. Perfectly correct. An immense admission for a man not otherwise sane. Up to that point he could have written chapters 3. And 4. Of my suppressed gospel. But there we seem to separate. He seems to concede the indisputable and unshakable dominion of motive and necessity, call them what he may, these are exterior forces, and not under the man's authority, guidance or even suggestion.
Then he suddenly flies the logic track, and, to all seeming, makes the man, and not these exterior forces, responsible to God for the man's thoughts, words and acts. It is frank insanity. I think that when he concedes the autocratic dominion of motive and necessity, he grants a third position of mind, that a man's mind is a mere machine, an automatic machine, which is handled entirely from the outside, the man himself furnishing it absolutely nothing. Not an ounce of its fuel, and not so much as a bare suggestion to that exterior engineer as to what the machine shall do, nor how it shall do it, nor when. After that concession, it was time for him to get alarmed and shirk, for he was pointing straight for the only rational and possible next station on that piece of road, the irresponsibility of man to God. And so he shirked, and arrived at this handsome result. Man is commanded to do so and so. It has been ordained from the beginning of time that some men shan't and others can't. These are to be blamed. Let them be damned. I enjoy the Colonel very much, and shall enjoy the rest of him with an obscene delight. Joe, the whole tribe shout love to you and yours. Mark. We have not heard of Joe Goodman since the trying days of 90 and 91, when he was seeking to promote the fortunes of the typesetting machine. Goodman, meantime, who had in turn been miner, printer, publisher, and farmer, had been devoting his energies and genius to something entirely new. He had been translating the prehistoric Mayan inscriptions of Yucatan, and with such success that his work was elaborately published by an association of British scientists. In due time a copy of this publication came to Clemens, who was full of admiration of the great achievement. To J.T. Goodman, in California. Riverdale on the Hudson. June 13, 02. Dear Joe, I am lost in reverence and admiration. It is now 24 hours that I have been trying to cool down and contemplate with quiet blood this extraordinary spectacle of energy, industry, perseverance, pluck, analytical genius, penetration, this eruption of thunders and fiery splendors from a fair and flowery mountain, that nobody had supposed was a sleeping volcano, but I seem to be as excited as ever. Yesterday I read as much as half of the book, not understanding a word, but enchanted nevertheless, partly by the wonder of it all, the study, the erudition, the incredible labor, the modesty, the dignity, the majestic exclusiveness of the field, and its lofty remoteness from things, and contacts sordid and mean and earthy, and partly by the grace and beauty and limpidity of the book's unsurpassable English. Science, always great and worshipful, goes often in odd and gray, but you have clothed her in garments meet for her high degree. You think you get or pay for your 20 years? No, oh no. You have lived in a paradise of the intellect whose lightest joys were beyond the reach of the longest purse in Christendom. You have had daily and nightly emancipation from the world's slaveries and gross interests. You have received a bigger wage than any man in the land. You have dreamed a splendid dream, and had it come true, and today you could not afford to trade fortunes with anybody, not even with another scientist, for he must divide his spoil with his guild, whereas essentially the world you have discovered is your own, and must remain so. It is all just magnificent, Joe. And no one is prouder or gladder than yours always, Mark. At York Harbor, Maine, where they had taken a cottage for the summer, a pretty place, with Howells not far distant, at Kittery Point Mrs. Clemens' health gave way. This was at a period when telegraphic communication was far from reliable. The old-time Western Union had fallen from grace. Its system no longer justified the best significance of that word. The new day of reorganization was coming, and it was time for it. Mark Twain's letter concerning the service at York Harbor would hardly be warranted today, but those who remember conditions of that earlier time will agree that it was justified then, and will appreciate its satire. To the President of the Western Union, in New York. He Pines, York Harbor, Maine. Dear sir, I desire to make a complaint, and I bring it to you, the head of the company, because by experience I know better than to carry it to a subordinate. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.